brethren and sisters in the Lord Jesus Christ. When we come to part two of the book of Joshua, we find that the major wars against the Canaanites are now over. Those major wars have been accomplished in three major campaigns, which are outlined for us on the chart on my far left. You'll recall that first of all, the Israelites drove a wedge into the centre of the land. Then they conducted their campaign, which subdued the south. And from there, in the third major campaign, they moved into the north. But when we find that the major wars against the Canaanites are now over, all that that really means is that organized resistance has now been crushed. And there are still wars to be fought. And there's a very profound lesson in that for every spiritual Israelite who is making their way toward the glory of Zion. That section of the book of Joshua is to remind us that the warfare of faith will never be accomplished in a few short, sharp, spectacular victories. The warfare of faith may indeed be spectacular in many respects. There may be major campaigns against sin, accompanied by major victories. But the warfare is long. The warfare takes time. The warfare takes a toll of faith and resistance. But it remains pretty fought. And many, unfortunately, have the view that the warfare against the Canaanites was all accomplished in the first part of the book of Joshua, and that all that remained was for the tribes of Israel to march throughout the length and breadth of that land, take possession of it, and settle down and live happily ever after. But that is not so. There still remained, as we read in Joshua 13, much land to be possessed. But they had to go in and take it, and they had to fight for their inheritance, as we shall see in the chapters before us during the course of these studies. The warfare was still to be waged. And what had been accomplished in the first part of that book and in the first section of that narrative is that all organized resistance of the Canaanites had been crushed in the head-on confrontation with the army of Israel. But the Canaanites still remained. The Canaanites were still to be subdued in their various areas, their various cities and towns. And the tribes of Israel were now to go in and to take possession of that land that God had given to them. And I believe it is profoundly significant that part two of the book of Joshua begins with a very sober exhortation. And the sober exhortation is found based in the words, "Now Joshua was old and stricken in years." That in itself may not seem a very sobering exhortation, but believe me, it is. Not because of those words, but because of what Joshua endeavored to establish upon the basis of those words. Joshua was now old and stricken in years. And although Joshua had fulfilled his ministry according to Yahweh's requirements, there is an important exhortation in those words. If we are striving to be diligent in serving Yahweh and the truth, we can never hope to finish the work in our own lifetime. That's the exhortation of the opening words. We can never hope to finish the work in our own lifetime. What we must do, therefore, is to see that there are others to follow who will take up the work, so that we may deliver the work that remains to be done in the warfare of faith into the hands of capable and dedicated younger brethren and sisters who will be moved with a zeal and fired with a dedication and a determination to take up the work of the warfare of faith where we leave off and carry on. And that is the exhortation in those opening words. Joshua was old and stricken in years. But he was not content merely to die, a dignified old man. In his remaining time, he worked desperately to see that he would leave behind him a generation who would follow on where he leaves off. And we had just been explaining to the young people in the teenage class, under the theme of Nehemiah, that we need Nehemiahs in every age. There must always be Nehemiahs, as there must always be Joshuas. There must be dedicated men and women of the faith, who will not only be dedicated themselves in the work of Yahweh and the welfare of his people, but who will endeavor to see that by their own example, and by their own way of life, and by their labors in the truth, that the truth will remain preserved and in dedicated hands from one generation to another. And that was that which Joshua had before him in the remainder of this book, that that challenge might be met, and that though the older generation may pass away, there must be successors for Joshua. And we look at the ecclesial world today, and we need to look very carefully at those words of Joshua in that opening verse. And we need to remember that we must be dedicated today, not only to the work that is now in hand, but to the welfare of the future of the ecclesias of God. The next generation must be preserved. Our children have got to be fired with a zeal and a dedication for the truth and the things of Yahweh. They have got to be filled with a determination that they are going to let nothing stand in their way from putting Christ first in their lives. And if our family life is not generated upon that basis, if our way of life does not demonstrate that we really mean that, then it is useless to talk about it. No good talking about it, we've got to do it. And Joshua, of course, stands forth as a shining example in that regard. Here was a man whose life was dedicated. And here, of course, is the work of subduing sin in the warfare of faith. And in the chapters that remain, we learn that the work of subduing sin is not accomplished over a few years. Nor does a spectacular series of victories indicate that the victory has been final and complete. Because the victory will not be final, and it will not be complete until the Lord Jesus Christ comes and we stand before him and he tells us that our warfare is over and that the victory has been accomplished. Therefore, the second part of the book of Joshua conveys that dramatic and vital lesson to us, that the warfare must be maintained until such time, as Yahweh says, that further contention is no longer necessary. Our attitude must remain positive and alert. We must continue to exercise the attributes of faith and courage. And the faint-hearted and the unwatchful will not come through to the final victory. Let us remember that and let us mark it clearly into our minds. The faint-hearted and the unwatchful and those who are not dedicated to their cause will not come through to the final victory. And that is the lesson of the second part of the book of Joshua. Those who have studied again of the earlier chapters know how thrilling it is to read and to learn of the way in which Joshua stood to a man, where the people of Israel stood to a man behind Joshua in those three major campaigns. How that they put all selfishness to one side. How that they closed their ranks and united together. And they went forth in a warfare the like of which the world has never seen. And they established a series of the most spectacular victories that you could ever imagine. But they did not maintain that condition of mind. That's what we're going to find during the course of this week. They did not maintain that condition of mind. They did not remain positive. They did not remain totally dedicated. They did not remain ever alert and filled with faith, go forth to subdue that land. And the result was that the land was never, ever fully subdued. And so Joshua reminds them of that in that 13th chapter. In the second verse, he says, "This is the land which yet remaineth." And in the verses that follow, reference is made to the confederated cities and communities of the Philistines. And in the north, the Sidonians. And the inhabitants of the area between the Lebanon and the anti-Lebanon mountains. There was a huge area that was still not in the hands of the Israelites. And he mentions those areas, and he elucidates them for us. He mentioned specifically the five lords of the Philistines. He goes on to show that these areas have not yet been subdued, but it is necessary that it should be done. He goes on in verse 4, taking us to the very borders of the Amorites, an area which was on the east and the north, the northern borders of the kingdom of Bashan. So you see, here was a vast area that still challenged the people of Israel. And the question was, what would they do about it? In verse 6 we read, all the inhabitants of the hill country, from Lebanon unto Misrephoth Maim, and all the Sidonians, them will I drive out from before the children of Israel, only divide thou it by lot unto the Israelites for an inheritance, as I have commanded thee. Now here you've got the clear promise of Yahweh, so far as the warfare of faith is concerned. God says now the same as he has said throughout the book of Joshua. You go forth in faith, you show your dedication to the hope of Israel, you reveal the qualities that I demand in my people, and I will drive them out. And over again he has said that. This is the lesson of the book of Joshua. Yahweh saves. They couldn't save themselves. There were no men on earth who could give them that land. But Yahweh could give it to them. Yahweh could deliver it into their hands, every square inch. And that's exactly what he says. I will drive them out. But notice the next phrase. He says, I will drive them out from before the children of Israel. Only divide thou it by lot unto the Israelites for an inheritance. And then you've got a type of the work of Christ, who according to Revelation 22 and verse 12, will give every man according as his work shall be. And the fact is, of course, that all will not receive the same reward. Some will receive 10 cities, some 5 cities, and so forth. But that is typifying the work of Christ in delivering the inheritance into the hands of those who will be redeemed, those who will have fought valiantly in the warfare of faith. But you see, Yahweh says, I will drive them out, but you divide it by lot. In other words, God will work in cooperation with his faithful people. And so in verse 7 the instruction is given. Now therefore, divide this land for an inheritance unto the 9 tribes and the half tribe of Manasseh. Now here was a command for the allocations to be made, after which each tribe would be required to go forth in faith and take his inheritance. But it should be carefully noted that the places named in these preceding verses, the first 6 verses of this chapter, never truly became a part of Israel. Never at any time was that instruction ever really fully fulfilled. And yet they were included in the places promised to the people of Israel, as you will see in Numbers chapter 34. Promised but not possessed. Why? Because the true Israel of God, the perfected spiritual Israel of God, has not yet come on the scene to take possession of that land as it was promised to Israel in times apart. So let's look at that, and let's look at it very squarely from Joshua chapter 13. They never ever really took possession of their land because they had not sufficient faith or dedication. They were not prepared to do that which God required of them in faith, that he might drive out the Canaanites. But do you know it's a very glorious point that's made in the very final word of the prophecy of Zechariah, where Zechariah's last word is that the Canaanites shall no more dwell in the land in that day. And do you know that that comment of Zechariah is virtually a direct reference to Genesis and the coming of Abraham into that land, wherein we read that the Canaanite was then in the land. Zechariah says, the time will come when Jesus Christ has returned, when the multitudinous Israel body after the Spirit has been received unto him, when they will march upon that land, and when they will fulfill the promises God made unto Abraham. The Canaanite then will not dwell in the land, because there will be a spiritual Israel to take possession of that land and to see that the promises of God are fulfilled. Now we need to think about that very, very carefully, because we look back on the days of Joshua and the days of Moses and the weaknesses of the history of the children of Israel, and we say, tut, tut, how could they ever do that? What an appalling lack of faith. Isn't it terrible that they weren't sufficiently dedicated? Here was God prepared to do all these things for them, but what did they do? They fell down on the job. You can't understand it, can you? That's the way we're inclined to talk. But look, we hope to be part of that glorious body referred to in Zechariah 14. We hope to be part of that spiritual Israel who is going to see that the Canaanite will not dwell in that land. Therefore, let us learn from the problems and the difficulties of the past. Let us see the need for a total dedication to our cause, that we might be fitted and prepared to be part of that Christ body when the time comes. And when once again a greater Joshua will divide that land, and when the tribes will have their inheritance. But what do we find as we move on through that chapter? Look at verse 13, for instance. Nevertheless, the children of Israel expelled not the Geshurites, nor the Maacathites, but the Geshurites and the Maacathites dwell among the Israelites until this day. Until this day. Now you see, throughout the lifetime of Joshua, these Gentiles remained. And it means that the lesson of the Scriptures had not been learned. Turn with me to Leviticus chapter 20, verse 24 and 26. Now there is a vital principle set down here, which Israel should have wholeheartedly followed. Leviticus chapter 20 and verses 24 to 26. We read that in the fourth year, all the fruit thereof, chapter 20 of Leviticus, verse 24, but I have said unto you, ye shall inherit their land, and I will give it unto you to possess it, a land that floweth with milk and honey. I am Yahweh your God, which has separated you from other people. Separated you from other people. Ye shall therefore put difference between clean beasts and unclean, and between unclean fowls and clean. And ye shall not make your souls abominable by beast, or by fowl, or by any manner of living thing that creepeth on the ground, which I have separated from you as unclean. And ye shall be holy unto me, a separated people. For I, Yahweh, am holy, and have severed, and that's the same word as the word separated, up in verse 24, I have separated you from other people, that ye should be mine. Now that lesson had become lost on Israel. They fought valiantly while there were spectacular victories, but in the day-to-day hard slogging through life, where the same principles and qualities were to be exhibited, they had grown tired and they had manifested a lethargy, which meant that they did not carry out the principles of the truth. Now turn over to Numbers chapter 23 and verse 9. And note the principles set down here, which had again become lost sight of by the majority in Israel. Here is one of the mighty prophecies of Balaam. Now you see, those words in Leviticus that we have just read meant that if Yahweh was going to give that land to Israel, they had to take total possession of that land. That they not live cheek by jowl with the Canaanites in the land. Deuteronomy chapter 7 said that those Canaanites were to be exterminated. Now Israel didn't do that. But do you know there is an Israel of God that is going to fulfill that principle of the book of Leviticus? And they're referred to in Numbers chapter 23, verse 9, in the prophecy of Balaam. For from the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I behold him. Lo, the people shall dwell alone, and shall not be reckoned among the nations. That's what Yahweh desired in the days of Joshua. That was his purpose for that nation. A purpose that remained unfulfilled. But Zechariah tells us that after his feet have stood upon the Mount of Olives, the greater Joshua, after he has perfected the spiritual body of true Israel after the Spirit, then the Canaanites shall no longer dwell in that land. What I'm getting at, brethren and sisters, is this, that it will take an Israel of greater dedication, of greater faith, of deeper determination to bring these things about than the Israel whom Joshua led. That's the point. And I hope that we can see that. And I hope that we can see that if we are going to cleanse that land of the Canaanite and take possession of it according to the glorious promises of the past, we will need to be a lot more determined and faithful people than the Israel of the past. And so, in that 13th chapter, we find that exhortation emerges. And Joshua lists the areas that have not yet been possessed. And they prepare to divide the land by lot, that they might be ready to deliver it into the hands of the various tribes. But there is one point made there in that chapter that is an absolutely glorious lesson. And it's found in the 14th verse. And as all the tribes excitedly prepare for the lot to be drawn and to receive their inheritance in that land, there was one tribe that stood aloof from the proceedings that followed. And in the 14th verse we read this, only unto the tribe of Levi he gave none inheritance. The sacrifices of Yahweh Elohim of Israel made by fire are their inheritance, as he said unto them. And those are beautiful words recorded for a beautiful purpose. You see, Levi, as a priestly tribe, was a type of what the whole nation should become. Levi was a type of the perfected Israel. Levi, in many respects, was a type of ourselves. Levi is set forth as a type of what the entire nation should have been. Their life was to be devoted to offering up sacrifices unto their God. And Levi typified that in the whole nation. They were not to be concerned with material possessions. And it's because of the remarkable part that Levi plays in that type that we find so much of the apostolic writing sprinkled with Levitical allusions. Paul in Romans 12, verse 1, one of the most well-known verses in the Bible in Christadelphia, I beseech you, brethren, that you offer up your bodies as living sacrifices. What's he talking about? He's talking about the spirit of Levi. There are Levitical overtones in every word in that verse. We immediately think of priests. We think of the function of priests. And we think of the work to be undertaken by priests. Look at such passages as Philippians 2, verse 17, 1 Corinthians 9, verse 13, and all the way through the book of Hebrews. And you get the Levitical overtones placed upon our worship of the great God of Israel. We are to be the antitype of Levi. The question is, how many truly devote their lives in this way? And yet how wonderful to devote one's life to searching out wisdom and knowledge, to offer self to Yahweh upon the altar of sacrifice, and to endeavor to lead others in that same way. That was the purpose of Levi, so far as the unfolding of God's purpose was concerned. So Levi had none inheritance in that land. He was not to be concerned with materialism. He was not to be concerned with the things of this life. He was to be free from those things, that his life might be entirely dedicated and devoted to the service of God. And having set that down, we now learn of the end of Balaam in the 22nd verse. Because for all his work in undermining Israel, we now find that he comes to his end. This chapter goes on to show us the way in which that was brought about. Verse 22 tells us that Balaam also, the son of Beor, the soothsayer, did the children of Israel slay with the sword among them that were slain by them. And so, in going in to take up this land, one man did meet the death that he so justly deserved. Balaam met his end. And you know that the word Balaam signifies wasting of the people. And you might recall that the advice of Balaam, at a time when he was called upon to advise how Israel could be destroyed, was the only advice that was really effective. Because he said to Israel's adversaries, don't try and fight them, corrupt them. And that's precisely what they did, as recorded in the book of Numbers. But he was a waster of the people, in that he drew away the people of God and wasted their spiritual strength and faith, and therefore undermined and destroyed them. But eventually, he met the end that he so richly deserved. And these words would indicate to us that instead of returning to his own land on the Euphrates in Mesopotamia at Pethor, he apparently joined the Midianites for a season. Verse 21 would appear to indicate that. And Moab and Midian had been linked in the hire of Balaam in a treacherous conspiracy against Israel, to which we have already alluded. So that here Balaam, remaining with these people, meets his end. He is termed here Balaam the soothsayer. It's the only place where this word is translated in this way. It's a word which means to distribute or to determine. And therefore, by implication, it means to divine or to be a soothsayer. But its primary meaning is to distribute or to determine. And that which he distributed and that which he determined was the product of the carnal mind. So here in Joshua 13, Balaam stands forth as a type of sin, that which wastes the people of God, and he must be dealt with. And so the carnal mind, as embodied typically in Balaam, is put to the sword. And we know that the sword is a symbol for the word of God in Hebrews 4 and verse 12. This is a way to deal with Balaam, with the sword of the Spirit. This is a way to deal with the Balaam of self, the Balaam of sin that would waste away our faith and destroy us. And it's rather interesting that Balaam, in Numbers 23 and verse 10, had made a plea that he might die the death of a righteous man. That had been his wish, declared in print in the Word of God, that he might die the death of a righteous man. But he died the death of a sinner. And sin must be destroyed in the same way. And so there in that chapter, Balaam is finally and completely brought to account for his misdeeds. And in that chapter he symbolizes sin in all its evil manifestation against faith that God would use to save us. And so the chapter goes on, and we find that there is a reference in verse 23 to the inheritance of Reuben. But you want to note their geographical position. They were in a very, very difficult situation over here, on the eastern side. It's rather interesting here to find that Reuben was exposed to the temptations of Moab's worship, the worship of Chemosh. And there's a very profound spiritual lesson in that. I want to show you a little bit later on how that there were only three tribes who picked out their own inheritance. The Arabs eventually were content to wait for it to be allotted by Yahweh. But you might remember there were three tribes went to Moses down here in the plains of Moab. And they said, look, if it's all the same to you, we know what we want. Moses said, what do you want? They said, we want this and this and this. Thank you very much. Moses said, well, that'll be all right, but on condition. When you arrive in the land of Israel, you've got to cross over Jordan, you've got to fight with your other brethren to subdue the land on the west. Then you can go into that inheritance. But I want to make the point that they picked out their inheritance. But look where they were placed. Reuben, Gad, Manasseh, chief by Jael, with the Canaanites that remained in that part of the land. An important lesson there. They liked the land. It was beautiful. It was ideal for what they wanted. But they were right on the border of the foe. The Gentiles, the Moabites, the Ammonites. Among the most evil people who had ever drawn breath since the time of creation. And those who lived nearest to the foe must be the bravest. They must be the most courageous, and they must be the most spiritually mature. You see, these tribes over here in their inheritance, they had a buffer between them and the east, and the buffer was Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben, and they hadn't thought of that. They hadn't thought of that. They had thought, look, that's the part we want. Is that all right, Moses? Sure, said Moses, that's all right. Upon the condition. But they hadn't thought of the other implications. And do you know what finally came upon those tribes? When Assyria came to utterly disseminate the kingdom, the first three tribes hauled away into captivity were Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben. A very interesting point. And the point is, let Yahweh determine our inheritance. Let's not be in too much of a hurry to say, I'd like that, thank you very much. Leave it to Yahweh. He has greater wisdom. He can see implications in things that we don't discern. He knows what is best for us far more than we know ourselves. Those three tribes forgot that. But they learned the lesson. And they learned it the hard way. Let those of us who feel that we can live closely in association with the influence of evil Gentiles such as Moabites and Ammonites, let us remember that those who live in that way need to be the bravest. They need to be the most mature and the most courageous and the most determined. And if we don't feel that we fall into that category, let us stay away, well away from every influence that would otherwise undermine our faith. And so we find listed in the words that follow, the reference to the tribe of Gad in verse 24. In verse 28, it continues too with a reference concerning the tribe of Gad. In verse 29, the tribe of the half-tribe of Manasseh. And finally, in that chapter in verse 33, there is a final point made that is a reiteration of verse 14. In verse 33, we read this, but under the tribe of Levi, Moses gave not any inheritance. Yahweh Elohim of Israel was their inheritance, as he said unto them. The final word in that section is a further reminder that Levi was a type of the entire nation and a type of spiritual Israel. But it's a repetition of that which was made in verse 14. Why the repetition? Why the repetition? The request by the eastern tribes for their inheritance to be on the east side of Jordan was self-centered. That's why we've got the repetition. First to Levi, then to the three tribes, then back to Levi, to center our eyes and our attention upon that priestly tribe. The tribes who had requested inheritance on the east were self-centered in their ideology so far as inheritance was concerned. They had seen the land with their eyes and not with the eye of faith. It was a request that had at its root covetousness. And what a powerful contrast there is in chapter 13 between these tribes and the tribe of Levi, of whom it is said simply that they received no inheritance. Yet really, which should be preferred? True inheritance, so far as the things of Yahweh are concerned, can never be measured in material things. And that's why Joshua chapter 13 is in the Bible. That's what the 13th chapter of Joshua is about. True inheritance, so far as the things of God are concerned, can never be measured in material things. We read something of Levi, but we don't read of those three tribes. We read Yahweh was their inheritance. Could you ask for anything greater than that? Levi's inheritance was spiritual. And a total dedication to the things of Yahweh will involve sacrifice of earthly things and a repudiation of the pursuit of material advantage. And do you know that David knew that? You come with me to Psalm 73, where David shows us that he wants to be numbered among the antitypical Levites. David understood with real clarity the lesson of Joshua 13 that we have examined this morning. David understood that powerfully, and he leaves us in no doubt as to what his feelings were. He saw the ancient tribe of Levi as a type of the true spiritual Israel of God, and he wanted a part in that, and he expresses himself in that language. In Psalm 73 and at verse 26, this is what he says: "My flesh and my heart faileth, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever." Now that word portion is elsewhere rendered inheritance. My flesh and my heart faileth. You can pursue material advantage all you want it, which is what that psalm is about, incidentally. You can pursue material advantage like the three tribes on the east, Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben, until your tongue drops out. But your flesh and your heart will fail. You might even get a heart attack over it. But he says, God is the strength of my heart and my inheritance forever. In other words, the man that wrote this psalm wanted to become an antitypical Levite. He would sacrifice everything that this life had to offer, if need be, to become an antitypical Levite in the glorious age that is to come. And so the covetousness of these three tribes in due time brought its own reward, and accordingly they found that their early aspect of wanting to pick out their own inheritance, rather waiting for God to prescribe it unto them, brought in due time its own reward upon them. Now we look on a little further, and we look initially into the 14th chapter of the book of Joshua. And we find here a special message in regard to Caleb. But before we get to Caleb, we find that the work has begun in regard to the allocation of the areas to the tribes. We read in the opening verse that these are the countries which the children of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest and Joshua the son of Nun, and the heads of the fathers of the tribes of the children of Israel, distributed for inheritance to them. By lot was their inheritance, as Yahweh commanded by the hand of Moses, for the nine tribes and for the half tribe. I want you to notice something particular. It doesn't say in verse 1, Joshua and Eleazar. It says, Eleazar and Joshua. Now that is vitally important, Joshua was not placed first. This was primarily a spiritual activity. And therefore, the priestly role takes precedence over Joshua. Even though he was the most prominent man in Israel at that particular time. Israel were applying the requirements of the law. Deuteronomy 17, verses 8 to 13. And Numbers 27, verses 18 to 21. Some magnificent verses that you want to turn up and have a look at. This was a spiritual function. It was to be effected under divine guidance, under providence. And therefore, the priest took precedence over the king. And yet, in actual fact, you've got here in the 14th chapter of Joshua, in this opening verse, a glorious picture of the coming kingdom age. Then no more will the Canaanite dwell in that land. Because we have married there together in that first verse, in regard to the work of allocating the tribes, the threefold aspect of king-priest. Here we have Joshua and Eleazar typifying Christ and all the saints as they subdue that land and go forth to divide it among the tribes for the glory of the kingdom age that is yet to come. And we also find mentioned in that first verse the heads of the fathers of the tribes. So that there is a beautiful picture there in that 14th chapter of a united nation of Israel all working together under the leadership of the king priest. The way in which they are united, the way in which they work together on this cause is a wonderful example of the way in which in the kingdom age to come, Israel will be renewed in heart. Then they will have a new strength and a new faith. Meanwhile, the spiritual Israel of God, the Israel that is now being developed down through the ages, the ones who see the dangers and the follies of the past, the ones who are prepared to put their faith and their hope and their confidence in Yahweh, and to walk humbly before Him according to His divine principles, to give Him honor and glory and service in all that they do in life, after the type of the Levitical tribe, they will be the ones perfected to undertake the work in the glorious age to come. They will work with the Eleazar Joshua man. They will be associated with him in that work, and they will subdue that land. And they will be perfected in their personage, that they might be then fitted to guide those 12 tribes to their inheritance in that land in due time to come. And so verse 2 says that they were to receive their inheritance by lot. And the Hebrew word goral signifies to be rough as a stone. Therefore, it represents a pebble. And you want to have a look at Revelation 2, verse 17, for the Antichrist. Because those who are found by Christ to be worthy of inheritance in that kingdom will be given the pebble of acceptance. And they will pass into the glory of the age to come. And they will receive once and for all their eternal inheritance in the land of Israel. The question is, explain these terms, the half side of which one was it you wanted, Manasseh. You'll recall that Joseph, in receiving the birthright in Genesis 48, will find that his two sons, who feature prominently in the chapters that are immediately before us, particularly chapters 15, 16, and 17, that although they were two sons, they received one inheritance. So that scripturally they are referred to as half tribes, in that together the two tribes make up one inheritance. But because of the effect of the inheritance of Joseph, they were raised to full tribal status among the tribes of Israel. And that is why they are sometimes referred to as the half tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. And Joshua's opening comment regarding the fact that there is much land which yet remains, all the borders of the Philistines, Geshuri, and from Sihor. Now, the phrase rendered there in verse 2, all the borders of the Philistines, is better rendered as in Rotherham and the Jerusalem Bible, where it is rendered in both those versions, all the regions of the Philistines. Joshua was not concerned merely with the borders. You see, the fact is that all the land of the Philistines, which The fact is that all the land of the Philistines, which they occupied down the coastal strip here, all the area of the Philistines really belonged as part of the inheritance of Israel. And that's why he emphasizes that. So instead of being translated all the borders of the Philistines, it should be rendered all the regions of the Philistines. And the word borders or regions literally in the Hebrew signifies circuit or circle, which emphasizes it even more. All the circle of land occupied by the Philistines rightly should have been seized by Israel. Now, Geshuri, which he mentions there in verse 1, is an area east of Jordan, between the Sea of Galilee and Lake Huba. Those Philistines were well entrenched in that land at that time. But as far as the word Sihor is concerned, the Hebrew there has the definite article, and therefore it should be translated. In other words, there's no place called Sihor. It means Black River. So that it should be translated in our Bibles, from the Black River. From the Black River. Now, it's almost impossible to define where that Black River was. But many claim that it is a reference to the Nile. And that what Joshua is saying there is that they are concerned not only with the area of land occupied by the Philistines, but by the area from the Nile to the Euphrates. They've got to remember the Abrahamic promise. They've got to remember that they must subdue those Philistines, and that they must subdue the whole land from the Black River to that area in the north. And it's rather interesting that so far as the Philistines were concerned themselves, they were never fully defeated by Israel until the times of David. And then they were put under tribute. And I can't imagine why David did that. They should have been annihilated upon the basis of Deuteronomy chapter 7. But they were never defeated by Israel until the times of David. And even then they were not destroyed, they were put under tribute. And just one final point as far as the Philistines are concerned, we must remember they were not a Semitic people. And at the time of Joshua, the Philistines inhabited all the coastal Mediterranean plain from Joppa right down to south of Gaza, an area about 50 miles long and about 15 miles wide. Therefore, they remained a thorn in the flesh of the people of Israel. My dear brethren and sisters, in the Lord Jesus Christ.